Welcome to HMSC Connects, where we go behind the scenes of four Harvard museums to explore the connections between us, our big, beautiful world, and even what lies beyond. My name is Jennifer Berglund, part of the exhibits team here at the Harvard Museums of Science and Culture, and I'll be your host. Today, I'm speaking with S.D. Bijou, a biologist and professor in the Environmental Studies Department at the University of Delhi, who is currently a fellow at Harvard's Radcliffe Institute of Advanced Study. He's also an associate at the Museum of Comparative Zoology and the Department of Organismic and Evolutionary Biology at Harvard University. He's a biologist who studies amphibians like frogs, caecilians, and salamanders. He's described more than 100 new species and even two new families of Southeast Asian amphibians. Throughout his storied career, he's taken stunning photographs of his subjects, which will feature in a new exhibit in the lobby of the Harvard Museum of Natural History this April. I wanted to ask him about his fascinating life of discovery and the ways in which the knowledge he has gained has educated him about the massive loss of amphibians we are experiencing worldwide. Here he is. S.D. Bijou, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for having me.
You were first trained as an ethnobotanist in India, and that earned you your first PhD. It's pretty incredible. You have two PhDs. But you became enamored of frogs while doing your field work, and that led you to your second PhD. So tell me about that journey.
I have a different childhood. I can say I was born in a small village in the state of Kerala, that is the southern part of India, in a regular lower middle class family, largely practicing agriculture for daily life. Especially my schooling was quite different from others. I started serious formal education only after the age of 15, but I enjoyed my childhood walking along with my parents. My native place is somewhere very near to the backdrop of Western Ghats, in fact. I learned a lot of things from the nature, and I spent most of my time along with my parents for supporting them. My primary day-to-day duties involved in taking care of my cows, taking them for grazing, and other related agriculture household activities. Every day I had to sell milk on the local shop before going to the school. All other time I just played and roam around. And the biodiversity-rich Western Ghat biodiversity hotspot, where my backyard, I can say, is my playground. Living close to the nature and spending time there taught me more than what I learned from the textbook in the school. I think that ignited my interest in wildlife later on in my life. When I got an opportunity to get out of my village and undergo the formal training and education and become a scientist to learn wildlife and nature. I started my professional journey as a plant scientist after obtaining my first PhD from Calicut University, that is my native state in India. After getting this PhD, I joined as a scientist in a research organization for studying ethnobotany, mainly to study the medicinal property of plants, usually the tribal community are using for diagnosing their ailment and treating illness. For this work, that is an opportunity for me to travel extensively in the Western Ghats biodiversity hotspot along with the indigenous people. The tribes that live inside the forest, they're amazing people, in fact. Their knowledge, especially related to the wildlife, is extremely brilliant. I spent over 40 years with the different tribal communities in India as the part of my research, right from Kani tribes in Kerala to the Apatani tribes in Arunachal Pradesh of Northeast India. I'm very sure, you know, without their support and the local involvement, it is quite impossible for me to study what we are doing now in the field. And as you very well aware, that amphibians are usually in the night, in the pinch darkness in the forest. So the tribal's knowledge is absolutely very much essential for conducting the successful expedition in the night in the forest. Many of our tribal community and their people, they can identify many of the flora and fauna that plants and animals in and around their locality with their own identification traits. They easily identify and communicate very easily the species of animals and plants. Their sharp observation and understanding nature is extremely remarkable, and they often surprise me with their identity. Yeah. Of course, I can come back to your second part of the question, how I turned from plant science to animal science. That very frankly, that in fact is quite accidental. During my plant expedition, I always take a special attention to photographing other subjects like frogs and almost everything what I'm seeing in the field. Frogs really fascinated me due to their lovely popping eyes and extremely vivid colors. Mm-hmm. You can't believe the frogs are extremely brilliant in colors. They're sometimes is much brilliantly colored than the conventional sort of belief like butterflies and birds.
Yeah.
Gradually, I started taking more and more photographs of frogs from different parts of India. And after attaining several photographs in my collection, I really try to identify them. What are the frogs which I photograph in the field? I try to identify with scientific records like literature and all other available form of reference. But I miserably failed. I found it is extremely difficult for me to identify those animals I photographed from the field. I contacted both national and international experts for their help to identify that photographs. But sometimes the response may really not very helpful, or even sometimes it is not satisfactory. However, one reply from the famous American herpetologist, the late Robert Inger, changed my life. Bob said that many of my pictures could be new species and also appreciate my photograph and photography techniques. I was literally excited. I decided to study Afibin more professionally because of that particular statement that changed my life completely.
There's clearly a need in India.
Yeah, that is true. And absolutely, I have to be very proud, and I have to be very honest. That particular few lines from Robert Inger transformed my life from a plant scientist to animal scientist. In fact, in the principles of taxonomy, that's a branch of identifying the species, is same for both animals and plants.
Okay.
I can say another example, the late Professor V.V. Sivarajan, my earlier mentor in plant taxonomy, taught me the skill and the special eye to train a taxonomist and identify the species. Mm-hmm. This learning I applied for my amphibian research, in fact.
Yeah.
Very frankly, I never find any difference between plant taxonomy and animal taxonomy at any stage of my professional journey. Very frankly, that is true.
Yeah.
So finally, I resigned my plant job and I joined for my second PhD at the age of 40 or maybe 41. That was a tough decision.
I was about to ask, how excruciating would that have been, where you were just like, oh, I took all this time doing this first PhD. How long did it take you to decide to go for it?
Yeah, it was a really tough decision. I honestly say, yes, it's a tough decision. But I was convinced myself, okay, this is most important. Would you look at this? We have to do that. I hope I can do that. I wanted to study the frogs very seriously, and I moved to Bridge University, Brussels in Belgium for my second PhD under the supervision of Professor Frankie Bosseth. And interestingly, and very fortunately, Robert Inger became my PhD jury chairman. That was exciting. Yeah.
That was really
coincident, right? Look at me, the first letter I received from him and inspired me a lot to study the frogs of India.
Yeah.
And interestingly, and very fortunately, Bob was my PhD jury chairman when I was there in UB, Belgium. After that, I moved back to India and joined Delhi University as a faculty in 2006.
Okay. I have to ask, did you ever tell Robert Inger that what he told you changed your life?
Yeah, of course. When I was there in Belgium, I had an opportunity to meet him briefly. Then I explained. Then that time he was completely aware that I transformed from a plant scientist to animal scientist, and my publications appeared in Nature and so many other journals. So he was so excited. I show my gratitude and appreciation for his valuable encouragement from him to transform me as a plant scientist to animal scientist.
Yeah, I'm sure that meant a lot to him.
Yeah, that is true. From that point onwards, I'm doing only my frog research in my professional career.
Okay, so go on. You take a faculty position at this new university. And what happened then?
The university always has a different sort of engagement. Mm-hmm. I spent nearly 3 to 4 months always for conducting the field expedition in the various part of Indian jungle to collect the resources for the next lab studies along with my students and my collaborators. That's a very challenging task, especially as a faculty in a university. The teaching is the major objective of a university. I hope that is everywhere in the world like that, including Harvard. Of course, that is a challenging part of my journey as a faculty in a university for conducting the field expeditions. Especially amphibians are most seasonal animals, and we can find the animals only during 3 or even maximum 4 months in a year, that also in the monsoon period.
And that's just presumably because there's a lot more moisture. Yep. Amphibians need moisture.
Amphibians are very seasonal. We can find those animals only maybe in India, I can say from May, June, July, August. After that, it's actually the activity is always very less. So we had to be there in the right time and the right place conducting the field expedition to find the animal and documenting, especially for photograph.
What do they do in the non-monsoon season? Where do they go?
I'm not using the word hibernate. Probably they're inactive and they always hide under the log or somewhere under the rocks. And they're coming out only after the first shower, that is in June or maybe in July.
As you alluded to before, you are also a photographer. This is why I'm speaking with you, actually, because we're exhibiting some of your photography in the entrance of the Harvard Museum of Natural History. That's coming up soon. You are known as a photographer as well as this incredible herpetologist, amphibian biologist. So as a photographer, I'm curious, what's your strategy for photographing frogs in the wild? And what do you look for as a scientist? What do you look for as an artist? And where and how do the two converge?
Yeah, frankly, I'm not sure I'm qualified to say myself as a photographer sometimes, very frankly. But I love photography than anything in my life. When I do frog photography, I think my mind mostly works as a scientist. I try to capture as many as possible scientific characters like color, shape of the body, and different angle for capturing the scientific identification. That is extremely important. Actually, if you are making an artistic picture, sometimes it's looking very nice, but we are not able to identify by using that particular piece of photograph. Scientific identification is sometimes very difficult. But I also do artistic photography. I don't know, artistic photography is an appropriate word to use like this. Amphibian photography is extremely challenging. Why? Because amphibians are a nocturnal animal. We can find those animals only in the night. So invariably, we have to use the flash. Without flash, we are not able to capture a frog real in the wild. Many times I had to capture the beauty by using flash photographs. And it is very challenging. You know that frogs usually, their skin is always moist. The skin always creates some light patches on their bodies. That is always a challenge. And the capturing an animal behavior in the field is, very frankly, is always very difficult. There has to be a balance in between artistic photography and scientific photography. Oh no, for the last 3 decades of my scientific, I can say the photography, I learned some sort of improvised technique, how to photograph frogs in appropriate light to avoid this patch on the body sometimes. That is the only thing I can say. Altogether, I really enjoy photography in the field. In fact, I can say that make my research more enjoyable than anything in the field while I'm conducting very tensed field work. Actually, you know that the walking in the jungle, in the forest, especially in the night, it is a little bit tensed, actually, always a great challenge. And again, we had to photograph by using flashlights. That's altogether, it is a very challenging job, but it is more enjoyable while I'm doing the field work along with the photography.
I might argue that it is artistic what you're doing. Yes, you are looking for certain anatomical characters or behavioral characters for science, but you have a very charismatic subject. You have these really beautiful animals that are vibrant colors, that have these really sort of curvy aesthetic lines. I think there's an argument for what you're doing. Often an artist is trying to tell a story or make a point. You're doing the same thing. You're trying to tell some sort of story about a physical feature, kind of more from a scientific side. But the line between art and science here, I think, is blurry, is what I'm saying.
No, of course, I'm not saying it is very big issue for photographing animals in the field. But in my experience, what I learned from the field, that the time I'm photographing frogs, especially the aquatic frogs having very smooth skin with always very moist skin, when we use the flashlights, always invariably we will get a flash light on their body. So avoiding that particular thing is a challenge. That's what I said.
Yeah, absolutely. I can imagine. We were talking to a photographer last year who does underwater photography and was talking about how challenging it is to photograph tuna because they are basically a mirror underwater. So getting the right exposure is quite challenging. So I can imagine that it's similar with frogs for sure.
Yeah, that is true. I can say very well, Lisa, actually, it is not always possible to converge science and art, especially when photographing animals in the wild by using flashlight. That I can say very clearly. Sometimes we can see a very nicely exposed frog in a branch or a stone very near to the river or some other water bodies. Mm. But after we capture the animals, we can find sometimes it is not very good because of the angle and the light. And apart from that, the wet skin is really having a lot of reflection of flash. So that is very challenging. We have a wonderful image, but finally, it is not that much.
Yeah. No. I think that's universal in photography.
I completely agree. Even for extremely professional photographers, they also have the same challenge in the field. Because I know some of the renowned photographers, I also plan to walk along with them in the jungle. They also said the same thing, you know, after photographing, especially the frogs are extremely challenging. It's a challenging task for everyone, including highly professional photographers.
Yeah. You're a big deal in the amphibian world. I was reading all these articles about you. You've been called the closest thing Indian herpetology has to a celebrity and, quote, the frogman of India, unquote. How did you earn these titles and how do you feel about them?
Very frankly, I don't care about such big titles, right? And I'm honest, I have to say that. Or without that particular title, I will do the same job. And people know me through my work, in fact. I have been working on this field for over 30 years. And fortunately, I discovered a new species of frogs.
Including That's incredible. Wow.
Entirely new family of amphibians from India.
I mean, a new family. That is not a new genus, not a new species, a new family of frogs. I mean, that's significant.
Yeah, that is true.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just had to emphasize how important that is.
Thank you very much, Jennifer. Actually, discovery is always accidental. You are not able to go to the field with a torch light and say, oh, I am planning to go for discovering a new family. That is not possible.
Of course.
That is not impossible. Yeah. So I can say I'm fortunate to describe two different family of amphibians from India. And of course, that creates a lot of popularity for Indian amphibians, of course, to me also. Through that, I also became known to many people. People attribute a frogman, probably I believe that some by media reports, I believe. Yes.
Yeah, of course. Right.
It's a BBC. They attributed to me as a frogman initially. Then we have a tendency to glorify people doing the work sometimes than the subject they are working on. Of course, it is a recognition for my work too, I believe. But part of the overlooked forms of life, such as frogs, are getting more and more attention and appreciation in the mind and hearts of general public. That's the reason I really like the media is giving a lot of importance for frogs. I believe that is a wonderful opportunity to explain the importance of amphibians in our ecosystem or in our planet.
I think all of these discoveries that you're making, these incredible discoveries, I mean, the number of species that you've named, it really highlights that there has been this deficiency of research and herpetological research in India, and that it's a really important region in terms of biodiversity.
I believe India, I'm fortunate to be an Indian. It's actually, India is one of the most important biodiversity centers in the across the world, actually. Hmm. Have an extraordinary species diversity, and many species are not known to the science so far. This is not only the case of frogs. Look at other forms of lower forms of life, invertebrates. There are enormous number of species are still waiting to get the proper naming. So I believe India as a region, it is an amazing place for scientists like me to understand, explore, and find new forms of life.
Do you have a favorite species?
Yeah, no, that is a difficult question for me. Very frankly,
I'm sure.
It is really hard to pick a favorite one for me. All frogs are wonderful, and it is very close to my heart.
Yes.
And really, I love all of them, very frankly, yeah. Yes. For the sake, if you're asking the question again, I wish to pick one frog, that is Indian purple frog. Indian purple frog is actually a new family, which I described in 2003, along with my PhD advisor, Frankie Bosith, and described as a new family of frog as Nasica batrachidae. That, in fact, fortunately, I published in Nature.
It's a big deal.
For me, that frog made my life today.
It made you the frog man of India.
Yep, absolutely. But, Indian purple frog is really a celebrity in the amphibian world.
Yes.
It is more appropriate to call this frog as a celebrity in Indian herpetology. That I can say very, very strongly. It's a celebrity all over the world, especially in Indian herpetology.
It's amazing.
It is look like a ball, sometimes a blotted balloon, with extremely tiny eyes and a very long pointed nose. That make this frog is unique from all other frog across the world. Many people sometimes is really not ready to believe it's like a frog.
Yeah.
The most amazing part of this frog is its life cycle. It is very weird, actually, I can say that. This frog live under the soil, sometimes deep up to 20 feet, and is coming out only for 1 or maximum 2 days in a year.
Wow.
This visit is only for two things, that is mating and laying eggs.
Wow.
Immediately after laying their eggs, both the male and female again retreat to the dark depth of solid earth. It is one of the most ancient lineage of frogs, which evolved approximately 80 million years ago and diverged from its African relatives in Seychelles Islands.
Whoa.
In fact, the discovery of the African relationship of these frogs provide as an important piece of evidence of breakup of Gondwana land. This makes this frog more special and popular among, I can say, even not only for the herpetologist, but also for the endure biologists celebrated the discovery because of the combination of different reasons, what I explain now.
That's amazing. So there's so many stories packed into this one family.
Yeah. I have a lot of favorite folk. I can say every discovery has at least one interesting story behind.
Yeah.
I can tell a small story about one of my recent discovery from the Western Ghats.
Oh, please.
It's a very unexpected discovery. That animal we described as a new genus from roadside puddles. Roadside water puddles. And we tend to believe, Jennifer, we tend to believe all the discoveries, one has to go to the forest and deep forest, we have to search and find a new frogs or a new species. That is not true.
Sometimes they're just right under your nose.
Yeah, exactly. In this particular case, we described a new genus of frog from the roadside puddles. Exactly, roadside puddles. Unfortunately, this animal is currently critically endangered, according to the recent IUCN Red List categorization. This frog was discovered and described along with my PhD student. It was known only from only a single locality in highly disturbed habitat. I cannot say it is a habitat. It is a roadside puddle, I can say. Like this, I can go on talking about so many amphibian discoveries which are very close to my heart. But unfortunately, I don't want to stretch my all 100 discoveries.
And I could ask you about them forever. So
that is true.
Why do we need to know and discover new species?
Yeah, I need to give this answer. And before that, I have to explain a little bit about the background. Life originated on Earth about 3.5 billion years back.
Yeah.
And currently, scientists identified 1.7 million species across the world, including water, land, and air. And however, very frankly, our knowledge about Earth biodiversity is far from complete. This 1.7 million species is a tiny slice of what exactly we have in our planet Earth. I must say the Earth true diversity could be somewhere in between 10 million or even up to 100 million species. So our knowledge is about the global biodiversity is less than 10%. That is the starting point of any discussion related to the discovery of new species. That is the most important things I have to say now. Then immediately the next question people genuinely asking, what is the importance of biodiversity? That's a question I face in many time in my public talk. Firstly, as a scientist, scientific pursuit to understand the nature and the wonderful discovery of life that has evolved during the course of Earth history, which we are also the part. And human being as a species, we are also the part of the global biodiversity. Honestly, that is the truth. And secondly, even if we look at in a human-centric point of view, our own survival as a human is depend all forms of life together in our ecosystem. Biodiversity, according to me, it is so important and is most essential to understand and document the species. And we are living in the world where our actions are putting other forms of life in danger. Biodiversity is rapidly depleting across the world because of human and our involvement in habitat loss and climate change. To understand how to conserve a species, we have to understand what to conserve and where to conserve. That is extremely, extremely important before making any conservation action plans. This is the first step so that without understanding and accurately identifying a species, we cannot make any meaningful conservation plans. Apart from discovering species, is not just a scientific exercise. It's also important for social welfare. For example, without documenting species in an area and their threatened status, we cannot make any sustainable development plan. For the sake of human welfare, we always tend to ask the question, what is our use from this biodiversity? We use biological resources for developing medicinal drugs from plants and animals. I can explain by using a simple example. Let us take the discovery of penicillin that is used for the treatment of bacterial infections. It was isolated from a species of fungi. The genus name is Penicillium, and scientifically we can call Penicillium notatum. Now I think the name is Penicillium chrysogen, but only some members of this genus actually produce Penicillium molecules that has antibiotic properties. So, if we want to isolate their life-saving drugs, we need to correctly identify the right species of Penicillium out of 350 species available or known to the science from everywhere in the world. So accurate identification of a species is extremely important to understand and isolate any sort of chemicals or any sort of biomedical products from plant or animal-based discovery.
Yeah, it's so, so important. Just the fact that species are in such decline just as we're making these discoveries, it really just speaks to the need for us to continue making discoveries and continue understanding our planet as best as possible. I think this is particularly important in the amphibian world because it's correct, right, that amphibians are declining and are the most threatened group of vertebrates on the planet.
Yeah, exactly. Without a background, sometimes it's not able to explain. Amphibians arrived on Earth about 350 million years before us.
Yeah.
The ancestors of present-day amphibians evolved from water to the land. And we can say they are the first land vertebrate to conquer the solid Earth.
Wow.
Amphibians lived along with dinosaurs. And amphibians are the only animal witness and successfully survived and see all the extinction events of all the dinosaurs and continue to live with us today. As of today, a total of about 8,700 described species of amphibians in three major order, Sicilians, frogs, and salamanders. They're found almost everywhere. Some species are deep under the soil. Some species we can find on the stream. Some species we can find even the forest canopy. Amphibians are the third largest group of land vertebrate in terms of their species number after birds and fishes. However, our knowledge about their wonderful group and their life remain limited. And our perceptions of amphibians is largely and generally very low. People tend to believe they are tiny, slimy, or even brown. Sometimes people not call their animals, they use the word creatures living in dirty puddles. Honestly, I can say that. And fairy tales also, you know, that the story of the fairy tales also portrays frogs as ugly. But only when we look very closer and closer, we will see the real beauty of these small life forms. I can say very loudly, frogs are much beautiful than any other forms of life. Even I can even compare with the so-called the most charismatic animal like butterflies and birds. Honestly, we can see the dazzling colors of frogs and look at Amazon and many parts of India. We have extremely, extremely beautiful frogs. But unfortunately, amphibians are the most threatened group of vertebrate in our planet Earth. Otherwise, we can say two out of every five amphibians are threatened with extinction risk. That means they are either critically endangered or even vulnerable by IUCN Red List.
Wow.
The major reason behind the rapid decline of amphibian is basically because of habitat destruction and habitat loss. The second major reason is the climate change and the various impact of climate change. Disease also continue to push the animals to the extinction, largely in South America and many parts of Africa, including North America. So it is very clear that we are responsible for the current state of amphibian decline across the world. Species are disappearing from Earth's surface faster than the natural background of extinction rate, and possibly even faster than we can discover them. Amphibians are an alarm bell for what we can expect from other forms of life. But we are still an opportunity to learn and prevent the extinction of amphibians from the world. Amphibians, for example, we can call as environmental barometers or environmental indicators. Due to their extreme sensitivity to small change in the environment, amphibians serve as an important indicators of overall health of a habitat. So amphibians' decline in a region is also a direct indication of the environmental health or environmental quality. Amphibians also the best friend of farmers because they consume millions of insects in an urban area in the larger landscape that is always is helpful for farmers to prevent the natural pest control. Likewise, I can say a lot of other important aspect of amphibians in our ecosystem, especially is an important role in food web and keeping the ecological balance.
What can looking at amphibians teach us about our place in the world and the impact we have on it?
As I said earlier, it's actually amphibians are popularly known as environmental barometers or environmental indicators. For amphibians can give an early warning about the quality of our nature. If anything happened in the wild, the first animal is getting affected by amphibians because they have a different type of life, especially their skin is extremely sensitive. If a small change in the water or in the air, they are the first animal, those who get some sort of information and through which we also learn more about the health of the particular environment and particular habitat.
You have this big exhibit coming up at the Harvard Museum of Natural History, and we're very excited about it, just to feature your beautiful photography. What do you hope our visitors at the Museum of Natural History will experience when they see your photos on display? What do you hope they come away from the exhibit knowing or experiencing?
I'm so excited, actually. I have just one hope, very frankly. I hope that my work and stories trigger a small spark of lovers of nature and wildlife, especially for the overlooked smaller forms of life like amphibians. Maybe they will appreciate their beauty, I'm very sure, because they're extremely colorful. And some of the photographs are really brown, red, and green, vivid green colors. So definitely that will create some sort of animal which they can love. And if we love amphibians, we will also care about their preservation, I am very sure. I am saying this from a frog's perspective because this is the tiny animal, and that is my constitution to argue for frogs. But I can say, generally, we care just a few large charismatic mammals like tiger or elephants. And the maximum, we stop the wildlife at birds. And after that, we don't have a list of wildlife. I'm talking about my countries, actually. I'm coming from a place, the tiger is always occupy the center stage when we talk about wildlife. So that means I'm giving an opportunity to exhibit some of my photograph in this particular exhibition is definitely as an important thing in my professional journey, I can say that. The list of wildlife does not end with a bird or mammals like tiger and elephants. It starts from microscopic bacteria in the soil that grow our food, to trees that maintain our forest, and the small animals in our wetland that give us fresh water. That means every forms of life is equally important. The entire biological world, the humans only came last on Earth. In fact, if you're talking about evolution, humans only came in last on Earth. I want them to take the large message. We have inherited a rich biological heritage. We are like custodians, and we have a big responsibility and task. And each of us can contribute in many small ways, I believe. I want them to take a large message and take it part of their own wonderful journey, irrespective of their age and career. That is the only hope for my upcoming photo exhibit at Harvard Museum. And of course, I believe even this podcast.
SD Biju, thank you so much for being here. This has been such a great conversation.
And thank you, Jennifer, for the opportunity to discuss about my journey and my discoveries with you.
Today's HMSC Connects podcast was edited by Eden Piacitelli and produced by me, Jennifer Berglund, and the Harvard Museums of Science and Culture. Special thanks to the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study and to SD Biju for his wisdom and expertise. And thank you so much for listening. If you like today's podcast, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, or wherever you get your podcasts. See you in a few weeks.